The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
What we're seeing here really is a majority of Security Council members tiring of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Clearly, you know, from the beginning of his term, and especially since 2018, President Trump has been attempting to ratchet up pressure on the Iranians, and that has included direct action, like the killing of Soleimani, but it's also included diplomatic efforts to unpick the JCPOA, the nuclear deal that the Obama administration had designed. Frankly, the real reason we think that the US has been really pushing on this issue is because it wants to move forward and find an excuse to undermine the JCPOA completely before the end of the president's first term.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 19th, 2020. Late last week, the UN Security Council voted down a resolution offered by the United States to indefinitely extend a conventional arms embargo on Iran set to expire in October. The lifting of the arms embargo was one of the sweeteners that was part of the Obama administration's Iran nuclear agreement. Now, the Trump administration has announced it will begin the process of triggering the snapback of UN sanctions on Iran using procedures outlined in UN Security Council Resolution 2231. A move that could be the death knell for the Iran nuclear agreement. I talked with Scott Anderson, my fellow senior editor at Lawfare, and Richard Gowan, the UN director for the Crisis Group, an independent research and advocacy organization, to talk through the legal and political issues and what will unfold on this issue in the weeks and months to come. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 19th. Scott Anderson and Richard Gowan on Disagreement in the Security Council and the snapback of UN sanctions on Iran. Richard, I want to start with the basics here. What happened on Friday up in New York, the Security Council vote, and what do we expect the Trump administration to do next?
Okay, last Friday, the US got a pretty humiliating defeat in the Security Council. It had tabled a resolution calling for an indefinite extension of the Iran arms embargo, which is due to end in mid-October. And although the Americans spent a lot of time leaning on both allies like the UK and also countries like Tunisia, they only got one vote in support of their resolution from the Dominican Republic. Virtually everyone else in the Security Council abstained. And China and Russia voted against them. Now, this was an embarrassment for the US, although they had expected to lose in that vote. And what it's really about is a much broader push by Washington to reimpose UN sanctions on Iran that were terminated as part of the nuclear deal in 2015. And having failed last week, we're going to see the US now use a mechanism called snapback, which I think we're going to discuss in a lot more detail, to try and get a general reimposition of sanctions on the Iranians.
And so, Scott, just if you could, for our listeners who don't necessarily follow this day in and day out, the resolution related to conventional arms, an embargo on conventional arms for Iran, what does that have to do with, or how is it connected to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the Iran Agreement?
So among the incentives that the Security Council helped put in place to encourage compliance on the part of Iran with the terms of the JCPOA in coordination with the other parties to the JCPOA was the suspension of a number of measures that it had adopted over multiple years, primarily in relation to its nuclear weapons program. But this included a variety of related provisions for related activities. So included conventional arms, included ballistic missiles, included some travel restrictions. And there was this sort of ongoing debate in the closing days, as I recall it, of this negotiations over the JCPOA saying, well, what should we do with these? Iran said they should all go away because they're all in response to a nuclear program that we're suspending and stopping. Other parties said, well, they're tied to the nuclear program initially, but they reflect broader concerns. So what should we really be doing with these? And the compromise was struck is that they would be sunsetted after a period of time. In October 18th of this year, that's when the more conventional arms embargo restrictions go away. I believe the travel restrictions go away then as well. And then 3 years later in 2023, the ballistic missile restriction will sunset. It's worth noting, these aren't the only arms embargo provisions that relate to Iran. A lot of the theaters in which Iranian arms transfer are most concerned have their own freestanding UN Security Council resolutions with arms embargoes. If you think about Yemen and Syria and different restrictions there, if not an embargo necessarily. But this one nonetheless is the one that's Iran's specific set of provisions, many of which were in place for many, many years before the JCPOA and UNSCR 2231, which kind of codified the JCPOA, or at least provided an international legal framework that helped incentivize and structure how the JCPOA would be implemented.
Okay, so that is helpful because I think it clarifies how the arms embargo is sort of intimately related to the Iran agreement. Richard, just walk us through, you know, you're obviously an expert on the UN. Walk us through kind of how we got to this moment. I mean, it's fairly unusual, I think, for the United States, which is obviously a permanent member of the Security Council, to, you know, suffer sort of an embarrassing defeat on a resolution. And so how did we get there exactly on Friday?
It's worth noting that this isn't actually the worst defeat that the Trump administration has endured in the Security Council. Last week, the US got two votes. There was one occasion in a debate, I think, over Gaza in 2018, where Nikki Haley couldn't even get a single country to vote with her on a resolution, I think, concerning Hamas. But this is unusual. And what we're seeing here really is a majority of Security Council members tiring of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Clearly, you know, from the beginning of his term, and especially since 2018, President Trump has been attempting to ratchet up pressure on the Iranians, and that has included direct action, like the killing of Soleimani, but it's also included diplomatic efforts to unpick the JCPOA, the nuclear deal that the Obama administration had designed. Now, the arms embargo is something that the administration has been focusing on because, as Scott says, it is coming due in October to end. But frankly, the real reason we think that the US has been really pushing on this issue is because it wants to move forward and find an excuse to undermine the JCPOA completely and essentially bring down the deal entirely before the end of the president's first term. Now, the Chinese and Russians have been criticizing this for a long time. The Europeans, especially France, Britain, and Germany, all of which are in the Security Council at the moment, have been very, very uneasy about it too. And I think that what happened last week was that the bulk of council members simply thought what we're seeing here is the US laying the groundwork for a final all-out assault on JCPOA, and we're just not going to be party to that. And even some council members, such as Estonia, who have quite good relations with the US and who we thought might vote with the Americans, didn't want to be involved because they could see where this was headed.
So let's talk a little bit about France and the UK, because it seems to me, I mean, putting aside the question of the JCPOA, isn't it the case that, you know, doing away with an arms embargo to Iran would make them nervous. I mean, aren't they, from a security perspective, concerned about Iran, you know, getting more conventional arms and potentially sort of unleashing more terrorism in the region, potentially in Europe as well? Do they not have a concern about getting rid of the arms embargo, or is it more like the broader picture that, you know, they're trying to preserve the Iran agreement?
The Brits, French, and Germans are all very keen to emphasize that they're not soft on Iran, and they take the Iranian threat seriously. And I think that if they had been looking at the arms embargo in isolation, they would have been quite happy to vote with the US. Behind the scenes, the Europeans have been trying to work out some sort of compromise around the arms embargo, perhaps extending it for 6 months or a year, for example. But the Europeans have all concluded that, firstly, Washington is not that interested in the conventional weapons issue, that it is, as I say, using this as an alibi, really, for a broader assault on JCPOA. And the Europeans have also concluded that what really matters is the nuclear issue. To be quite honest, the Iranians are pretty short on cash. You know, existing economic measures have already put the Iranian economy under a lot of pressure. They're probably not in a position to buy vast quantities of new weapons anyway. Most of the weapons they could buy at the conventional level are really not that threatening to the outside world either. Their arms exports are threatening. But nonetheless, the European view, and here I think the E3 are united, is that this is all of a lower level of significance than the nuclear file. That is why they decided they had to abstain on the US resolution, because they worried that they were going to alienate the Iranians and create a pathway for the US to attack the JCPOA.
And so do you think there could have been a draft of this resolution, as you said, maybe, you know, obviously the text of the resolution that was offered by the United States was essentially, you know, an unlimited arms embargo, reinstating an unlimited arms embargo. Do you think there was a deal that could have been made along these lines if the Trump administration had been willing to do so?
At the end of the day, quite probably not. And the reason for that is because China and Russia, on the other end of the spectrum, I think were very clear with the E3 that they simply wouldn't sign on to any extension of the arms embargo. They say that, as Scott pointed out, the JCPOA made it very clear that this embargo would end. It was a major incentive to the Iranians to sign the JCPOA. And China and Russia have simply argued that that has to be respected. I think it would have been almost impossible for the E3 to find a compromise that would sell not only in Washington, but also in Beijing and Moscow. But it's worth saying they did try really quite hard to work out a compromise of that sort. As late as last week, there was talk of the Europeans tabling a resolution of their own, but they realized that they could table nothing that would avoid a veto by at least some P5 members, so they stepped back.
Okay, so I want to move now to kind of what comes next. Obviously, President Trump and Secretary Pompeo have indicated that they will trigger the snapback procedures in UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Scott, could you walk us through a little bit of the nuts and bolts of how that will work based on, you know, your understanding of the resolution itself?
Sure, absolutely. The snapback procedure was one of these carefully negotiated, or at least widely discussed provisions when 2231 was implemented, in part because it was one of these items that the Obama administration pointed to say, here's a tool we can use to really hold Iran accountable and make sure it actually complies with the JCPOA. And the bulk of it appears in paragraphs 10 through 13 or so of UNSCR 2231. Paragraph 11 is really the meat of it. And it says that any JCPOA participant state, I'm going to come back to that term in a second because that's important, but any JCPOA participant state can trigger a process, the snapback process, by giving notice that it believes there has been some sort of activity that constitutes significant non-performance of the commitments under the JCPOA by a party. Not really clear on who. When that happens, there has to be a vote within 30 days on a resolution as to whether the terminations implemented by 2231, these are the terminations that benefit Iran, should be continued. If no such resolution is introduced within 10 days, then the president of the Security Council is supposed to be obligated to do so and put it forward for a vote within that 30-day period. Under paragraph 12 of the same UNSCR, if that resolution isn't adopted, then all of the terminations as of midnight 30 days later, GMT time, if I recall correctly, they all snap back. They're all reimposed. It is as if 2231 never happened and they all emerge with some caveats in there for certain contracts entered into and things along those lines that they do have little things to avoid certain types of disruption, but essentially restores these restrictions on Iran. Part of the legal debate about this and the why there's different views as to whether the United States can invoke this tool is because of that term I mentioned, JCPOA participants. The United States, of course, under the Trump administration, withdrew from the JCPOA, has criticized it immensely, has clearly indicate has no intent to continue to comply with it, and in fact, really hasn't. And at this point, I don't think anyone seriously disputes that Iran, including Iran, that Iran is now at least in certain ways substantially in violation of the JCPOA's original terms. Iran says, well, we didn't do it first, the United States did, and we spent a year or more complying with the JCPOA in spite of the United States' violations, and now we started taking violative actions, although not as severe or significant violative actions as they could in other circumstances. But to go back to that term JCPOA participants, most people will read that and say, well, look, if the United States withdrew, it's not a participant in the JCPOA anymore. So that can include the United States and it can invoke that provision. We even heard former National Security Advisor John Bolton make that argument over the weekend in saying why the Trump administration couldn't pursue this step. But if you look at paragraph 10, the way it defines that term is a little different. It actually gives a list of states, China, France, Germany, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, the United States, the European Union, and Iran. And then it defines them. It says a parenthetical and says, defines them as, quote, the JCPOA participants, quote, end parenthetical. The reason why that's relevant is that when you're reading things like a contract or a treaty or a statute, when you have that sort of definitional term, it defines it usually as a term of art, as a more technical definition that usually trumps the more conventional definition those words might have absent that specific definition. So the United States comes in and says, look, we are among this list of countries that it defined as the JCPOA participants. And therefore, that doesn't change. Nowhere in there does this say that the JCPOA participants only includes these states if they are continuing to participate. Instead, it includes these states, period. And therefore, we are still eligible to invoke this procedure because we are still considered, quote unquote, JCPOA participants as the defined terms for the purposes of UNSCR 2231, even if we are not the conventional definition of JCPOA participants, meaning people participating in the JCPOA.
So before we get down, really down into this legal question, Richard, I want to get your views on that. Richard, can you just tell us if the sanctions, the UN sanctions were snapped back into place, what would the sanctions actually be? Because my understanding is it's not the sort of broader US sanctions that were in place that really brought pressure on the Iranians to come to the table to negotiate the JCPOA, but rather a set of sanctions that were put in place by the UN and implemented by member states, in particular, the most important of which were basically some targeted sanctions on individuals and entities. So can you just tell us, like, what are the sanctions? If they were to be snapped back, what are they exactly?
They primarily concern military affairs. I mean, they include actually the conventional arms embargo that we were discussing. They are also covering some ballistic missile issues. And as you say, there are some targeted sanctions against individuals. Interestingly, there's also a reputational element because the Iranians have been very proud of the fact that they got out from Chapter 7 scrutiny by the UN. Their behavior had been defined as a threat to international peace and security, and that was ended through the JCPOA. But if these sanctions were to snap back, you know, Iran would once again be defined as a threat to international peace and security. And that's actually a classification which the Iranians find incredibly offensive. So it is partially to do with weapon systems. It's partially to do with individuals, but it's also to do with prestige.
Right. And so you know, moving to the legal issue that Scott outlined, Richard, I mean, I know you talk with representatives from the, you know, the member states, Security Council members. You know, what is the legal argument that, you know, Russia and China are making with respect to whether the United States can, you know, do this snapback procedure? And what is the argument that, you know, our allies, the UK and France and even Germany are making about how they read this on the legal side?
There's a variety of arguments out there. And the other participants in the JCPOA don't have a united view of this situation. China and Russia have stated bluntly that the US does not have standing. And Russia has pointed back to a International Court of Justice opinion from, I think, 1971 that states that when a country breaks its obligations under an international agreement, it loses its rights under that agreement as well. However, I think lawyers who've looked at the Russian argument say that it isn't quite as strong as it first seems, for quite recondite reasons to do with the case that it was originally involved with. The German line is also very plain. The German ambassador, Christoph Heusgen, has said in the Security Council that the US does not have standing. And the German view is essentially the plain language reading of the text that Scott describes is insufficient, that in interpreting a resolution, you have to look at the intent of the drafters and the behavior of the states involved. And if you look at those factors, then it is clear that the US is no longer a participant state in this agreement. France, I don't think, has been quite as blunt in public. Although there was a rumor that the French ambassador here had described the idea of the US triggering snapback as legally and politically obscene. So they don't like this very much either. The UK is a funny case, though, because the UK lawyers who've looked at this think that ultimately the US case that Scott describes may have merit. And they are more persuaded by the American legal reasoning than anyone else. However, the UK view is that whatever the legal argument, there's a more basic question about the legitimacy of the US trying to force snapback unilaterally, having left the JCPOA. And the British stance is that whatever the legality of this claim, it isn't legitimate.
Okay, so just sticking with the sort of legal side again, I mean, if you have, as we do here, disagreement among the legal advisors and among different countries, I mean, who would normally resolve a dispute like that? Obviously, the UN has an Office of Legal Affairs, there's an International Court of Justice. You know, are any of these bodies up at the UN in a position to, you know, opine or be a final word on whether, you know, the standing theory is valid or not? Like, how does it actually play out within the institutions of the UN?
This is a question that I've been asked a lot, and I think everyone is slightly horrified when you give the correct answer, which is that there is no one who can decide this issue. There really isn't any precedent for either the UN Secretary General or the Office of Legal Affairs, which is part of the Secretariat, interpreting a Security Council resolution, or at least the elements of a Security Council resolution of this importance in a case where the P5 disagree. The Secretariat will interpret more operational elements of resolutions relating to peacekeeping, for example, but there is no precedent for them actually deciding on the standing of a P5 member in a case like this. And I believe both Guterres and also the Office of Legal Affairs have made it very clear to the P5 that they are not going to provide an answer to this question, even if it is asked directly to them, that this is a political issue that the P5 must sort out rather than try and pass on to international officials. I think the best place to try and get some sort of firm decision would be the International Court of Justice, and that is something which has been discussed. But the problem with the ICJ is that it simply moves too slowly. At best, you could probably get an opinion within 12 months, But as snapback takes place on a 30-day timeline, that really wouldn't be relevant. So there is no neutral arbiter or umpire that can decide this legal question. And this is why it all really boils down, in the view of many council members, to a more political question of legitimacy. And the question that a lot of people are asking is, how will the council behave when the US makes this claim, most probably on Thursday or Friday of this week, and the majority of council members simply refuse to believe that it has the right to do so?
Right. So let's then go to, you know, how this really plays out. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of procedural things that can be done at the Security Council. Scott, you know, just as you think through it, the U.S. has said they're going to submit a complaint based on, if I'm not mistaken, substantial noncompliance by Iran under the terms of the Security Council Resolution 2231. That would then trigger this process. You know, Scott or Richard, you know, procedurally, what are the options for the United States? What are the options for those that oppose what the U.S. is doing?
Well, I think that there are two questions that arise there, or maybe two potential routes of avenue, although I think Richard may be in a position to illuminate on a few others. But the two that have been discussed is, one is this question of standing, and that is this idea about whether or not the United States can constitute a JCPOA participant for purposes of kicking this process off properly. It's worth noting that the paragraph 11 process that I discussed earlier hinges this notification on the belief by the JCPOA participant that there has been violative behavior, meaning it's a subjective judgment. So there's actually not clear, at least within the terms, the plain language of the UNSCR, whether that is a judgment that itself can be second-guessed by anyone. Because essentially it's saying, if that one party says, I believe it, then I believe it to be the case. And again, the fact that Iran's in at least some substantial violation of the JCPOA, if perhaps not as severe as it could be, I don't think is really seriously disputed at this point. The question then becomes saying, well, okay, who determines whether or not the United States has standing here? Some have put forward the possibility that the Security Council itself could decide, because the Security Council has two different sets of voting rules. It requires a 9 votes of the 15-member council to decide a procedural matter. And on substantive matters, it requires 9 votes of the Security Council, including the 5 permanent members, which of course includes the United States, China, Russia, UK, and France, all of whom can veto effectively because of that requirement. So if you could establish the JCPOA participant question as a procedural question, then in theory, the Security Council could resolve it and say, no, the United States doesn't count as a JCPOA participant on a procedural matter and void the whole determination. And really, the Security Council is itself the instrument that has usually played that role in clarifying how its prior Security Council resolutions should be interpreted. The problem with that is that there's traditionally the determination as to whether an item is procedural or non-procedural has traditionally been understood to be itself non-procedural, meaning the United States could hold a veto on actually reaching that question, what's called the double veto, which is a sort of procedural process that used to be used somewhat more frequently early on in the UN's history, the Security Council's history, but has really fallen into broad disuse and I don't think has been used in a while, although Richard may know when the last time actually was. The key point here is that there's just no easy out at this point in terms of how you actually resolve this. So what essentially ends up happening is they make this request. 10 days pass, presumably, where no one introduces one of these resolutions, and then it goes to the president of the Security Council to decide whether they comply or feel obligated to comply with the 10-day requirement where they're supposed to now introduce that draft. The current president is Indonesia. The next one is Niger. It's probably not a coincidence that this is happening now while they are in the presidency in the months of August and September, because they were preceded by, I believe, Germany and France, if I recall correctly. I may have that off. And they were are going to be followed by Russia in October, all of whom have pretty clear views on this and are themselves, you know, involved in the JCPOA process. So the United States may be hoping that maybe Indonesia or Niger will cave, issue that mandatory resolution after 10 days, and thereby kind of seemingly give its blessing or endorse the interpretation that, in fact, it's obligated to do this, that the United States has the standing to invoke this provision, require it to introduce this resolution. I'm not sure that's right necessarily, but it certainly is kind of the next procedural step.
Okay, Richard, how about you? How do you see this really playing out procedurally in the Security Council starting, you know, presumably next week?
To sort of go back to Scott's run of show, I don't think we will see other council members tabling a resolution claiming that the US does not have standing. By any reading of previous precedents and resolutions, that is a substantive issue. And the US could veto any resolution that is brought up criticizing it. So the idea that you can simply table a procedural resolution blocking the whole process, I'm afraid, is pretty fantastical. What I think will happen is actually going to be much more informal. And it comes down to a figure that Scott was pointing to as well, which is the Security Council president. What I think we will see happen is the current Security Council president, the Indonesian ambassador, say, I need a bit of time to talk to all council members about their views of this situation. And he will probably spend a few days next week in one-to-one bilateral consultations with his fellow ambassadors. It's worth saying that the Indonesian ambassador is a very professional guy, I think well-liked by his colleagues. He's not seen as a pro-American or anti-American figure. He's got some credibility. And I suspect what will happen is that he will emerge maybe in the last few days of August and say two things. Firstly, there is no consensus on whether the US has standing. And secondly, most likely the majority of council members feel that it does not. And he will then simply say that he as president, and indeed his successor, the ambassador of Niger, cannot be expected to run a snapback process according to Resolution 2231 when there is no consensus and the bulk of council members actually think the whole thing is fake. And so there won't be, I think, sort of big up and down votes. I think it's going to be slightly disappointing for the media, actually. Instead, it will be more a matter of a sort of a gently worded rebuke from the president. Now, that doesn't rule out a country then tabling the resolution continuing the termination of sanctions required by 2231. Niger, as the next council president, could do that. The Dominican Republic, which is the one council member fairly close to the US on all this, could do it. Or actually, the US can do it itself. If the US really feels it's important to try to have a vote, it can table a resolution saying that sanctions termination continues, and then it can veto its own text, which I think most people outside the UN would think slightly odd, but is completely acceptable. So there may be a vote. Equally, though, if the US tries to do that, there it is possible that Russia and China will come up with some procedural objections and will actually be able to use procedural arguments and measures to stop the vote happening. Anyway, there will be lots of games over this, and everyone will become increasingly confused. And the almost certain outcome is that after the 30-day period required by Resolution 2231, a council members will emerge in two fundamentally different universes. The US and perhaps the Dominican Republic will come out saying, snapback has worked. It is time to reimpose all pre-existing sanctions on Iran. And Russia, China, the E3 will most likely say, no, that is not true. This never had legitimacy. There is no change to the status of sanctions. And so you will have a very, very bizarre situation indeed.
So let's telescope back then a little bit for kind of what this means for the Security Council itself. And its own legitimacy here. I mean, on the one hand, you have UN Security Council Resolution 2231, which was agreed to by everyone. This was an unprecedented sort of snapback type of mechanism, which essentially only required one member to, you know, invoke. Will this ever be able to be a type of mechanism that will be used in the future? That's one question. And my second question, and I'd like both of your responses to this. Richard Goldberg, wrote an article in Foreign Policy on this question, and he's quite alarmed by the prospect that the snapback won't be respected. And he, you know, in that article, he says, what comes next could determine whether the Security Council survives the next decade. And I want to get both of your reactions to that, because it did seem like quite a strong sort of assessment of what's going on here. You know, do you agree with that assessment? How crucial is this to the sort of legitimacy of the Security Council going forward?
Well, I'll start. I think there is an argument there that there is a link that gives people pause for a good reason. The reason why the UN Security Council is useful, the reason why it's effective, is because it has this authority to bind states and give them obligations to be able to execute on the Security Council resolutions it adopts, whether they're sanctions measures or arms embargoes or other measures. And that kind of compulsory authority is important. And when you start moving away from a textual interpretation towards something that's much more heavily reliant upon purpose and the other factors that are a little more subjective, a little harder to measure, many people will not necessarily unreasonably be concerned that it gives more wiggle room by which states in the future will be able to evade Security Council obligations imposed by these resolutions. And I think that is a not unserious concern. I think it's also a good reason why perhaps the Trump administration should not be playing the sort of brinksmanship with an institution that the United States has benefited from in a myriad ways over the last several decades. That said, it's important also not to overstate the case in a lot of ways. Compliance with UN Security Council resolutions is far from uniform and far from flawless or perfect. In fact, a lot of resolutions that everybody concedes are binding and obligatory have compliance problems, including other arms embargo resolutions, including other embargo resolutions that relate to Iran, by Iran and by other states as well. So, you know, it's not clear that this is necessarily going to be a fatal incident towards the Security Council. But, you know, there is perhaps reason to be concerned that this might be another little chip out of its effectiveness in being able to coordinate and direct international behavior and behavior by UN member states, simply because it is legitimizing this non-textual, less controllable means of interpretation. Although, again, there is lots to be said for that means of interpretation and that it's legitimate. In fact, the ICJ and its 1971 Namibia opinion, which is kind of the only time it's really squarely laid out and says how you should be interpreting Security Council resolutions, kind of endorses it. The one thing I do think that means is that you might see a number of states kind of break into a third camp that kind of straddles the two that Richard laid out, which is that they will try and find a way to kick the can down the road a little bit after those 30 days goes away, not having to come down firmly on one legal conclusion or another, but instead try and find ways to say, well, we're still looking at the legal question as to whether this is obligatory, so that they don't have to decide this difficult question that might compromise certain Security Council interests on one side and the JCPOA on the other side. Maybe that'll involve some sort of referral to the ICJ for an advisory opinion that gives people a stalling technique. The Security Council probably can't do that over the US objections, which are almost certain, but the General Assembly could, or the General Assembly could empower other UN institutions to do so. So that's a possibility. Even if it doesn't get to that level, if that's institutionally not possible, we might see a number of states kind of take the issue under consideration and try and stall until January, when you see a new presidential administration that makes the question go away, so they never have to decide the hard question. Barring that, though, it's not clear, particularly if there's a second Trump administration, how they get away from actually having to make this difficult decision to say, no, in this case, while the Security Council resolution may say one thing, we're not going to interpret and apply it that way.
Richard.
I think the last point that Scott makes, which is that a lot of countries' calculations are related to the US electoral calendar, is absolutely crucial. I started discussing this, and my colleagues started discussing this, with diplomats in New York in late 2019 and early 2020 before COVID, at a point where the general assumption was that Trump would get a second term. And at that point, the conversations really pivoted around possible compromises on the arms embargo, sort of ways to placate the Trump administration. Now, since then, clearly the political dynamics in the US appear to have changed, at least for now. And I think ambassadors in New York and their political bosses back in Capitol see a Biden victory as more likely. And therefore, they are willing to say, OK, we're going to end up in a ludicrous situation where no one agrees the outcome of snapback. It's probably going to be very unpleasant. But we can take that unpleasantness if it lasts 3 or 4 months. And in fairness, you know, relations in the Security Council aren't very pleasant at all at the moment anyway. Right now, I think the US has been threatening to veto the extension of the peacekeeping force in Lebanon, which has been in place for 40 years, because they say it's not tough enough on Hezbollah. That infuriates the French. Just back in July, the US blocked a German resolution calling for a new UN envoy on climate change and security that Berlin really wanted. Relations are tense already. So I think a lot of diplomats say, fine, things are bad, they're going to get worse. But if you have a change of administration in January, we can start to rebuild. And hopefully the JCPOA will be just about alive and we can start to specifically rework diplomacy over Iran. If Trump wins another term, I think everyone thinks that the Security Council is going to be in a lot of trouble anyway, and the JCPOA is dead anyway. So US domestic politics are really the dominant theme in a lot of this discussion. Coming back to your other question, will council members ever agree to something like snapback again? I never thought it was very likely in the first place. It was a very, very particular complex mechanism designed by the Obama administration with France and others 5 or 6 years ago. It never seemed likely to become something that was a regular feature in council resolutions. And I think looking at the situation now, most sensible diplomats will simply say, we're never doing that again. So this is probably a one-off in the history of the council, and not a very edifying one, I think, whatever your standpoint.
I think that's a good place to leave it. And I just want to say thank you to Richard and Scott for joining me here on the Lawfare Podcast. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast, give us a 5-star review wherever you found us, and visit thelawfarestore.com to peruse our merch. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our audio engineer was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.